I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with Eric Draitzer of Counterpunch Radio. In addition to his podcast at Counterpunch, Eric has been an activist, commenting and covering issues related to war and imperialism since the Bush presidency of the 2000s. In this conversation, Eric and I discuss how he got involved in activism, as well as some of the controversies surrounding Counterpunch over the years. Then we get into Eric's recent interview with Barrett Brown, a former hacker involved with an early incarnation of Anonymous, who recently came out as a strong critic of WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. You can hear that interview over at Counterpunch Radio. After that, we delve into Eric's coverage of the Trump presidency and the rise of Trumpism, a movement that Eric considers even more dangerous than Donald Trump himself. We discuss all that and much more in this edition of Parallax Views. If you'd like to support Eric's work, I have included a link to his Patreon page in the episode description. With all that said, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Eric Draitzer. And to transition into the conversation, I've got a cover of Pillhead's Don't Stand in Line by the band Curb Dog. Check them out, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome to Parallax Views, Eric Draitzer.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to have you on because you're the host of Counterpunch Radio. Counterpunch is one of the best leftist. I guess it's a webzine essentially. They have a hardcover version, I believe, too, and it's been going strong for a long time. How did you get involved with Counterpunch and sort of left wing activism?
Well, those are two kind of different questions. To answer the first one, I got involved with activism going back to the Iraq War. Like many people of the late Gen X, early millennial window, the Iraq War was kind of formative for me. That began my freshman year in college, and that was kind of as I began to shape a worldview and a politics for myself, and began to kind of, I guess you could say, come into a more adult political mindset. And so a lot of my politics and early years of politics was shaped by the Iraq War, opposition to George Bush, obviously, and all of the issues that were really, I think, at the fore in the, the early aughts, the early 2000s. And so from there, I kind of evolved further and was, kind of traveled through various little circles as I moved from California, which is where I went to school and where I grew up, to New York, and became active in circles here. And I guess you could say it kind of went to the next level with Occupy. I was involved with Occupy Wall Street in Zuccotti Park from, I believe, about day 10 or day 11 or so. So right there in the beginning in the park, and kind of watched that evolve and then ultimately, sadly, kind of devolve. And from there, I felt it was important to, lend my voice into the media world, into the alternative media world, and to kind of try to provide the analysis that I felt was lacking. And one thing I should add, and this is something that a lot of people forget, is that Occupy Wall Street was kicking off right at the time when the war on Libya was happening. And part of my frustration with Occupy and with the culture of Occupy, or maybe I shouldn't say the culture, the participants of Occupy, was that there was so little of an anti-war message there, and in particular, an anti-war message around what was going on in Libya and around the Obama administration and NATO policy towards Libya. And that kind of, that lack of understanding, that lack of focus on anti-war issues also really motivated me to get into media work. And from there, I started my first website, Stop Imperialism, which still exists, although it's currently under some kind of renovation, and began my original podcast, which was called the Stop Imperialism Podcast way back when. And from there, things kind of snowballed. And then the other part of your question, I think around 2012, I started submitting articles to Counterpunch, became friendly with the editors there, and a couple of years later, there was a need for a podcast, and there we are.
Right on, right on. And I actually, if we can do a small sidetrack with Counterpunch, because I've been a big supporter of Counterpunch, even going back to the days when Alexander Coburn was running it.
Oh yeah, me too.
I think there's been criticism of Counterpunch in the past, because I know Alexander during the sort of the Bush era, there was sort of this idea that we could work with paleocons on certain issues like war and whatnot. So how would you respond to like those criticisms that Counterpunch engaged in a sort of like almost like a red-brown alliance? I think it's a bit overblown at times.
Well, it's definitely overblown. I'll speak frankly about that, because I've spoken about it numerous times. I think that number one, there's a misconception that Counterpunch has some kind of a political line other than general left politics. It really does not. Counterpunch, for the entire time that I've been following it, which is now, must be at least like 15 years, I guess. Counterpunch has always been a space with competing views. There are people from a variety of perspectives, although typically on the left. I guess maybe at one or two that I guess you could say aren't or weren't, but for the most part on the left, but with some differing views. And I always kind of appreciated that, particularly since I have to say that my own views have evolved as I've gotten older, as I've gotten more experience, as I've gotten more seasoning, both activist-wise and also in terms of media. And I think that Counterpunch has kind of exposed me to a lot of different perspectives, which I really appreciate. The other piece of that, I think, and I agree with you that it is overblown and it's certainly exaggerated, is the fact that typically when people make the argument that Counterpunch had provided some kind of a red-brown portal or something like that, which is absurd, and I can explain why I'm saying that in a second, but typically when they say that, they'll point to like maybe four people who contributed at various times to Counterpunch, all of whom no longer contribute to Counterpunch, all of whom are deeply reactionary, and three of whom, I would say, successfully penetrated a number of left circles, including Palestine solidarity movements. That would be like somebody like a Gilad Atzmon, who famously is an outright fascist, I would say, but who famously penetrated a number of left circles around Palestine solidarity work. Somebody like a Paul Craig Roberts, who at one time was publishing regularly with Counterpunch. That is an interesting story because Coburn and Paul Craig Roberts knew each other when Paul Craig Roberts was his boss at the Wall Street Journal. So that was a personal connection, and I guess a personal friendship that he had with Coburn. I can't really say because I don't know either one of them in a personal capacity, but that's my understanding of it. And Coburn felt that, you know, to give a platform to people who had something to say. I obviously disagree to a large extent with pretty much everything that comes out of the mouths of people like Paul Craig Roberts and fascists like Gilad Atzmon and others. So I don't really have any filter or censor when it comes to all of those things. And I think that the last couple of years, particularly in the Trump era, has revealed a lot of those people who for a long time, you know, fashioned a sort of a caricature of themselves as if they're some kind of rebels, as if they're anti-establishment people who are willing to work with leftists and all these other nonsensical things that I think have kind of been disarmed in the last couple of years. And I would add a number of self-proclaimed leftists who have also revealed themselves in the last couple of years to be, if not overt supporters of Donald Trump and the right, then certainly tacit supporters, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. So in essence, if you examine those criticisms of Counterpunch that you're referring to, typically they revolve around just a couple of people who contributed to Counterpunch, irrespective of the fact that literally thousands upon thousands of people contributed to Counterpunch over the last 15 years. I think the count is over 5,000 different contributors and authors, and we're really talking about like four or five. So when you said that the criticism is overblown, I couldn't agree more.
And, you know, the other criticism I think that gets leveled at Counterpunch a lot is one that deals with its late founder, Alexander Coburn, who, of course, having passed away, can't really speak to these criticisms, it should be noted. But Alexander was quite the rabble-rouser. Some would even use the term contrarian. I know some are upset still about the article he wrote, I believe, for The Nation in 2012 about Marine Le Pen, where he sort of, to me, he's saying that Le Pen is just a creature of nationalism that is exploiting tensions in Europe and that we should focus on our problems here at home. He also had some views on things like global warming and jury nullification that were uncommon on the left. I don't know if you can speak to any of that. Of course, again, Alexander can't really respond to these criticisms due to his passing. But I figured I'd let you, as someone who has been working closely with Counterpunch, I'd figure I'd let you address that.
No, of course, that's absurd and silly, and that's something that I think people use for their, because they have their own axe to grind and they want to smear either Counterpunch or me or Jeff Sinclair or Alex, and, you know, posthumously or what have you. And that's fine. I mean, people can say and do whatever the hell they want to do. I mean, it's the alternative media and it's no sweat off our back. But I think we should be clear that, number one, Coburn, you know, he passed away a number of years ago now, and he was not here for the politics of the last 5 years. And I think it, just my own personal opinion, if Alex were alive today, I don't think that those criticisms would be valid, because I think that his views would be a bit more aligned with what you see it from Counterpunch today anyway. Number two, I think that, again, there is a tendency among and I'll say that typically, and I don't want to broad brush anybody, but typically there are elements within some left circles, particularly older elements that go back to the 60s, who do see certain anti-establishment quote-unquote overlap with some right-wing figures, and I've opposed them quite vigorously over and over again because I think it's foolishness, and I don't think that there's any value in presenting somebody like a Le Pen or somebody like, you know, or something like Brexit or even Trump as some kind of anti-establishment figure. These are just creatures of the far right who have successfully rebranded themselves for a modern politics and a modern political context. And I don't think that there's anything terribly innovative about that. I don't think there's anything terribly exciting about that. What I do think is that they are certainly, and I think you mentioned the word, exploiting a political vacuum that is created by the utter bankruptcy of neoliberal capitalism and mainstream so-called liberal democracy. And they're exploiting that. And they use everything from anti-immigration scapegoating and xenophobia to outright fascist politics that is in various ways either overt or covert. And ultimately, I think that that's kind of the period that we're living through now. And I think that Counterpunch, in my personal opinion, has acted as a platform that has really provided a means to kind of take down a lot of these ideas. You'll note, by the way, and I'll mention one other name of somebody who I have zero respect for, Diana Johnstone, who was a regular contributor to Counterpunch, who wrote a glorious and glowing article about Le Pen. Well, that's the kind of degenerate nonsense and bad analysis that, in my opinion, is quite toxic on the left. And people like that need to be called out and taken to the mat for their BS analysis. I don't know if you cuss on this show or not.
It's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, they're bullshit analysis, man.
And, you know, the last thing in these sort of like left controversies that I wanted to cover, because
are these controversies?
I don't know. I guess there's always sectarian like
infighting. Yeah.
But, you know, when some of my friends found out I was having you on, because I sort of talk to everyone I can on the left just to get sort of I have a big tent approach to things. But there's been criticism of your past work with RT, and also I've heard people say that you were an Assad fetishist, which I find weird because you spoke out against Assad fetishism, as you, I think you even referred to it as that, when it came to Syria, I think a few years ago.
Yeah. So do you want me to run through that? Sure.
Yeah.
No problem. So, well, like I said in the very beginning, I began doing my website and my podcast in 2011. So the war in Syria was in its very early stages. My reading of the conflict in Syria was informed, as my reading of all events is informed, by through the prism of anti-imperialism. And my analysis at that time, for a few years after that as well, really focused on Syria as an epicenter of an imperialist assault on the country, namely through proxies in the region, be they Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, or what have you, the funding of the various jihadist factions and so forth. I mean, pretty much that was the analysis for a number of years. And, for me, just speaking for myself personally, I began to become increasingly uncomfortable with what I felt was I guess you could say a too one-dimensional of an analysis, one that I didn't feel comfortable continuing to espouse because I didn't feel that it was truly honest in an all-encompassing way. I felt that my analysis was in some senses sound and I could stand by it and I could stand by a lot of it today. But in other senses, I feel that I was irresponsible and unethical in overlooking both the human toll that was taken and continues to be taken in that conflict, and also completely overlooking and ignoring opposing and contrary views to what I was espousing. And I didn't listen to any Syrians who had different views than I had, and I didn't listen to anybody but those who continued to justify, reinforce, and otherwise buttress my own arguments, my own self-created echo chamber. And I felt very uncomfortable by that by about 2015 and certainly into early 2016. I will say, in addition to that, I was going through changes in my own life, including the birth of my first child, which changed my perspective even more so. It grounded me once again in a human perspective, one that I feel that I had maybe somewhat lost sight of in a lot of the analysis that I had been doing. And so what I tried to do was to try to recalibrate the way that I was approaching the conflict in Syria and the kind of analysis that I was bringing into, not objective, because I'm not, naive enough to believe in anything called objective journalism or even objective analysis necessarily, but rather one that was even-handed and one that really focused on, the issues at hand rather than my own ideological slant. So I guess in answer to your question, I began my political journey vis-a-vis Syria in one place, I would say squarely in what you could call a pro-Assad position. And over the last 7 years, I've shifted my position to what I hope is a bit more of an even-handed and a bit more of a for lack of a better word, a morally and ethically guided position that is still rooted in anti-war and anti-imperialism, but also does not ignore the reality of millions of people.
Yeah, I completely get that. People's views change over time, and it sort of leads into this other topic of, censorship and the control that, our Silicon Valley tech lords have over the discourse right now. One of my previous guests, Robbie Martin, his sister Abby, who works on Media Roots with Robbie, as well as her own show, The Empire Files, is now having problems with internet censorship. And I believe Counterpunch itself has had issues with censorship in light of all this Russia stuff going on now in the media.
Yes, I think those cases are slightly different. I can't really speak to the situation with Empire Files just because I don't have any of the details, and I certainly wouldn't want to speak for Abby or what's his name, Mike, or anybody else that's associated with the show, because I'm not really involved. But from a broad perspective, I know that I shouldn't say I know. My guess is that the targeting of a show like that is really the targeting of connections to Venezuela and Venezuelan funding and Venezuelan media and so forth, more than it is necessarily a targeting of Abby and her show. I mean, that's just my guess. I really can't say for certain. Certainly, that's supported by the fact that Venezuela analysis was temporarily taken down by Facebook and then restored. Same is true for Telesur. So to my mind, what we're really looking at in those cases is a specific and targeted attack against anything with connection to the Venezuelan government, the Bolivarian, the Bolivarian state, and so forth. With regard to the broader issue, I think that yes, to a large extent, there is truth to that. I think that sometimes people tend to overreact immediately. Like, for instance, I saw a bunch of people, going crazy on Facebook. Or was it yesterday or whatever, that their posts are being taken down? They're censoring me. And then everybody 2 minutes later is saying, oh, well, they actually just posted it right back up and it was something weird. So I think think that we have a tendency, maybe it's the Twitter culture that we live in or something, we have a tendency to instantly react to something and to say that, you know, it's immediately this one thing, when in fact it might actually be the confluence of a number of different things that are happening. Counterpunch has been victimized by this as well, both in terms of the censorship, and that specifically with regard to Google News and Counterpunch being removed from Google News, not removed from Google searches, to be clear, but removed from Google News. And then on the other side, Counterpunch's expose of the sock puppet account and sock puppet, I don't know, character, I guess you could say, that successfully catfished Counterpunch and I think published a couple of articles in Counterpunch until it was exposed by Josh Frank and Jeff Sinclair, the editors of Counterpunch. So, you know, it's kind of been experienced by any outlet, I think, on the left. It just depends on how you've experienced it and in what way. But ultimately, there's, I think, two questions here. Number one, the question of censorship and censorship within the context of these private social media platforms. I mean, I think we all know the difference between the government censoring a person and a private corporation blocking a person from access to their product. Clearly, two different things. Clearly not okay, and obviously a problem and something to be opposed. But I also think that it's incumbent upon us to think about what this really tells us about our dependence on these Silicon Valley military industrial complex connected companies like Facebook, Twitter, and the rest of them, that if we feel that we're so dependent upon these platforms for our own work, then maybe we also, while fighting to maintain our spaces there, and I'm not suggesting we abandon them, I think we also need to consider about alternative ways of organizing and alternative ways of getting our content out there. I understand that it's difficult now, considering these platforms seem all encompassing and pervasive, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. And I also will say that I think that there's a different experience when you consume content outside of the social media realm versus when you do within the social media realm. And so for me, I tend to use a lot of RSS feeds. I tend to collate a lot of information, a lot of news, and I'll use social media for the purposes of sharing them and disseminating them to the audience that I have on there. But I don't depend on Facebook and Twitter for information. And I hope that if anything, this is a little bit of a wake-up call for people that we can't be dependent upon these platforms, because they're not our friends, they're not going to help us, and they're not going to care about defending our rights or anything of the kind. I think that we need to fight and defend ourselves within the arena, but I also think we need to consider building our own arena.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I brought this topic up is because we have that article, the op-ed that came out in the Post, I believe yesterday, saying that, you know, the CIA needs to fund sort of an anti-communist culture war on the left. I think we do have to remember that, you know, just because the media is against Trump, right, it doesn't mean that the enemy of my enemy is always my friend.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely true. And I think that we have to become more discerning about how we consume information. I think we need to be discerning about the sources that we're using. I think we need to be very cautious about anything that comes out of the corporate media. But I also think we need to be cautious about anything that comes from Russian media and Iranian media and other media around the world, media that is in some senses competing for narratives, competing in the discourse. I think we need to be critical and skeptical of all of these sources of information. And I think we really need to, for lack of a better word, step up our game in terms of the way that we consume media, because increasingly it's become difficult to navigate. I'll tell you, just in the 7 years that I've been publishing content and, you know, writing articles, doing podcasts and so forth, it's changed dramatically. I remember when I was just on Twitter alone, when I was on Twitter in 2011, it was very easy for me to navigate through it, for me to post all kinds of content, links to articles with little commentaries and stuff, and they would be liked and retweeted all over the place. And you know, it was relatively simple. Now, Twitter, I mean, I hadn't been using it for quite a while, and I only just in the last maybe week, kind of got back to using it a little bit. And I find that it is almost unbearable. I mean, I don't know how people are picking through this endless maze of bullshit tweets and all kinds of stuff commenting on, you know, 700 people commenting on the same thing and none of it all that interesting. I mean, people wading through all of this, you know, Trump talked about draining the swamp. I mean, my Twitter swamp is almost unbearable at this point. So, you know, I do think that people really do need to consider the quality of the content that they're consuming and also the means by which they consume it. And I always urge people when they ask me, you know, how do you get all this information? Where do you get your hundreds of links and all this stuff? I say, not on Facebook and Twitter. I can assure you of that. I spent a lot of time building up a pretty large library of feeds and other things that I use. And, you know, I think that if people are really serious about information and about media and about diversity of sources, I think that you have to spend a little bit of time in that.
Right, right. And I think this is a good way to segue into your most recent episode of Counterpunch, which is Counterpunch Radio, which is why I wanted to have you on, because you have an interview with Barrett Brown that sort of deals with WikiLeaks a little bit. Could you tell my listeners who may be unfamiliar who Barrett Brown is and why this interview is so important?
Well, Barrett Brown is an award-winning journalist. He was involved in the early days of Anonymous. He connected with some circles of Anonymous and did work with them to expose private security contractors. I think probably the most famous example being H.B. Gary Federal, and, you know, a couple of these other companies. Oh, and Booz Allen Hamilton. He was involved in parsing through a lot of information, a lot of the information that came from WikiLeaks, and in publishing it and exposing a lot of the different plots that were being hatched against WikiLeaks, but in particular by these private military contracting firms. And for that, he was kind of seen as, in some senses, kind of an unofficial spokesperson for WikiLeaks back in the early days of WikiLeaks. And that's where I know Barrett from. I mean, going back to, like, you know, 2011, 12, whatever. Ultimately, he was arrested and he was convicted in court of, you know, for lack of a better word, he was crucified for his work with WikiLeaks and, you know, being involved in the, I guess what we call the transparency movement. And, for that, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison. He did 4 years in federal prison and got out in 2016. In that time, he was associated not only in a, you know, loosely with WikiLeaks, but also with the Courage Foundation, which is, in some senses, an arm of WikiLeaks, or maybe we could say an adjunct of WikiLeaks, that is there to raise funds for the defense of whistleblowers. And so he was connected with the Courage Foundation as well. And then again, I'm really kind of putting it in a nutshell. I would urge people to listen to Barrett tell the story. But in 2016, he is finally released. And once he's released, he eventually goes public with a lot of misgivings that he has about Assange and WikiLeaks and what Assange and WikiLeaks had become in that intervening 4 years. Remember that when Barrett went in versus when Barrett came out, WikiLeaks was in a very, very different place and doing very, very different things. And I think one of the things that Barrett really objected to, and I have to say I also strongly objected to, is Assange's and WikiLeaks' involvement with the Trump campaign and their direct intervention in the election. Now, anybody who is interested in my work can go back to what I was writing during the campaign, during the election season. If anybody has any belief that I have even the slightest sympathies toward Hillary Clinton, I would urge you to go look at my body of work and disabuse yourself of that notion. At the same time, I, like Barrett, had a real unease about WikiLeaks actively collaborating with Trump and the Trump campaign, which I believe quite strongly to be, if not fully fascistic, then certainly proto-fascist in a lot of ways, and active collaboration with the the Trump campaign is, at least for a lot of people, Barrett included, very much a red line that Assange and WikiLeaks crossed. And then in addition to that, there's a lot of questions about the way in which Assange and the various kind of small circle around him handle WikiLeaks and use WikiLeaks as almost a personal political vehicle rather than, a leaking outfit that is specifically designed for the purposes of leaking information rather than using information for its own political ends. And, one of the points that Barrett made in the interview, and I strongly agree with him, is that Assange presented himself as a revolutionary. And as a revolutionary, there are responsibilities that come with such a title. And to a large extent, I think Assange shirked those responsibilities for his own personal reasons, some of them totally understandable and totally valid. And I'm not suggesting that I can't possibly understand what he was thinking. At the same time, Assange doesn't have to necessarily live with the consequences of Trump. He's not a refugee on the border whose kids are being stolen from him. He's not, a black person walking the streets in America under Jeff Sessions' DOJ. He's not dealing with all of those consequences himself. So for him, it may have been a political question. For millions of people in the United States, this is a very tangible, very real issue. And to collaborate with Trump, I think to a large extent, really, it eroded a lot of the confidence that many people had in WikiLeaks, and I put myself in that category.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you bring up the revolutionary aspect that Assange tries to push for himself, because a lot of people will try to say, well, Assange didn't go after Trump and went after Hillary because Hillary wanted to target him so much. But the thing is, and I think Barrett brought this up in the interview, if you want to be a revolutionary, you do have to sort of take the consequences of that. If that means that the powers that be are going to go after you, I mean, that's the price you pay for going against the grain, if you truly go against the grain.
Che Guevara, Patrice Lumumba, we could go on and on and on. All of the great revolutionaries were targeted. All of the great revolutionaries suffered tremendous consequences, oftentimes paying with their own lives for their revolutionary ideals. And so it's certainly nothing outside of the historical, continuum that Assange would be targeted. And if anything, it demonstrates the importance of what Assange and WikiLeaks were doing, particularly in the early years of WikiLeaks. And I don't know. I mean, I can't really speculate on his mental state. I don't know if Assange has kind of lost it a little bit because of this isolation in the embassy. I don't know if Assange has just, become cozy with Roger Stone to the point where the alt-right seems more preferable to him than the left does. I have no idea. I know that his politics were never really left. They were some kind of anarcho something or other and
almost libertarian in some
almost
ways.
Libertarian, yeah, although certainly acceptable to a lot of the left, myself included, because I wasn't necessarily interested in Assange's ideas about free market capitalism. I was interested in Assange being able to leak information about what the U.S. was doing in Africa and what the U.S. was doing in Latin America and how they were actively, operating in Eastern Europe or what have you, the Stratfor emails and all of the other things that came out through WikiLeaks. That's what I was interested in, not necessarily Assange's politics. But as it has evolved, and this is part of the issue, is that Assange as a figure almost became inseparable from WikiLeaks as an institution, where a person would want to continue getting the kind of content that we were getting from WikiLeaks, but increasingly it was becoming difficult to support WikiLeaks without also supporting everything Assange said and did. And there is a certain cult-like, personality cult sort of element to it. And I'm certainly not the only person, and Barrett's not the only person to bring up that term. I mean, a lot of people, including people who work closely with Assange and WikiLeaks, have used that terminology. So I think it's complex. I think there's a lot of layers to it. And I think that we have to be able to walk a line between defense of WikiLeaks and defense of Assange against the imperial sort of consensus, but at the same time also having a critical perspective on what Assange did, what Assange continues to do, and the lies that he has presented to people as truths. I mean, I very distinctly remember Assange saying they had no preference in the election, they were not involved in the election, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And increasingly, as the information comes out, it's become more and more apparent that that's simply not true. So this is kind of the weird place that we find ourselves in, where you want to defend WikiLeaks on the one hand from its sort of neocon, neoliberal detractors, and at the same time, you want to attack those people that make Assange into a cult-like figure and make WikiLeaks into some kind of a personality cult.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to mention real quick, and then we'll move into other areas. One of the earliest critics that I remember of Assange was John Young, who runs Cryptome, which does a lot of the same work as WikiLeaks. And I think his main criticism was that, from what he could tell, Assange was sort of turning WikiLeaks into this vehicle to make himself sort of a media rock star of sorts, a cult of personality. And I think that we do have to toe that line, and we have to see that that seems to be what's going on, while also not towing the imperial line. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I just don't know why that's so hard for people to understand. I mean, we can do those things. We're capable of having a rational and nuanced analysis of something like WikiLeaks and Assange. I don't need to, you know, compose glorious, you know, paeans to Assange, the Christ-like figure who, you know, came to, you know, wash us of our sins. But at the same time, I also don't need to read about people, you know, saying that Assange is a traitor and that he should be locked away for the rest of his life and all of these things. I mean, these kind of extreme takes, the sort of hot take culture that we live in, it's not only unproductive, to a large extent, it's intolerable. And I think that we need to be able to have these kind of frank discussions, and I think we need to be able to have an objective analysis and a balanced one. And I mean, I hate to say words like balanced and objective because they're such loaded bullshit terms, but the truth is that we do have to be able to see a number of the nuances of a story like WikiLeaks, and one that is so critical to our own, politics vis-a-vis the imperial state.
Yeah, yeah. And it segues into some of the recent articles you've been doing. One that I found really interesting that I would recommend listeners read is the curious case of pro-Trump leftism. What could you give like a brief summary of what you were trying to get at in that article?
Sure. That article, I think, engendered a lot of strong reactions, as I knew it would, very supportive ones and very antagonistic ones. And that's okay. I think that we need to be able to have those kinds of conversations. But basically, the article has to do with I would say a relatively small but rather vocal segment of the left that is unable to separate Trump from his opposition to Clinton and to liberalism and to the neoliberal neoconservative consensus. In other words, a segment of the left that sees Trump as, you know, a racist and all the things that he is, but as not only preferable to Hillary Clinton and preferable to the Democratic Party, but one that actually benefits the left because of the sort of space that it opens up to fight against these entrenched forces. And you see this over and over again, where, you know, every time that Trump does some heinous act, like, you know, ripping children away from their mothers at the border, or, you know, the Muslim ban, or 1,000 other things that he has done in the short time that he's been president, you find a segment of the left that will instantly say, well, what about Obama? Well, Obama was the one who instituted the policy of family separations. Oh, well, Obama was bombing Libya, and Obama was arming the terrorists in Syria, and Obama was, you know, and it goes on and on and on, right? Recounting the laundry list of all of the things that we opposed during the Obama years that I was forcefully writing about and speaking on and all of the rest of that, right? This idea that everything that Trump does has to be seen in juxtaposition to what Democrats and liberals do, okay? So in other words, what you end up with is an argument that, well, every time we do this, we're providing a structural critique. And my response to that is, I don't think so, because I see no evidence for anybody who is persuaded from to anything with that kind of argumentation. I see it as the construction of a continuous echo chamber, one in which these people reinforce each other's attitudes and are able to kind of collectively absolve themselves of any kind of pro-Trump sympathies. Oh, we're not pro-Trump. We're not pro-Trump. We don't have anything positive to say about Trump. We just oppose Obama and Hillary and the Democrats, and we're going to continue hammering them because they're our primary enemy. And my response to that is, so that means then that you are not actually fighting the force that's in power. In other words, you're fighting one aspect of it. You're creating a phantom argument rather than actually engaging with the substance of what is happening right now. So, in other words, it's the difference between speaking to an immigrant organizer and finding out what are the real differences between life for undocumented persons under Obama versus life for undocumented persons under Trump. Tell me what real life is like for those undocumented people versus going on Facebook and saying, yeah, what Trump is doing is bad, but you know, Obama started this policy. In other words, they're completely different ways of approaching power and approaching an understanding of power and of formulating strategy for fighting back against it. In my view, if you're not engaging with those that are in power now and actively fighting against them now and undermining their ability to continue organizing and continue building their power, then you're not actually involved in the fight. And now I will just say, as the counter argument to what I just said, a person could say, and I would partially agree, well, there's a consensus between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats and Republicans are two wings of the same ruling class, and you need to understand it in that way. Well, of course, I'm a Marxist. I perfectly well understand that, and I've written that 1,000 times. At the same time, we're not vulgar Marxists. In other words, we're able to distinguish when the ruling class is having internal conflicts, and we're able to identify those locus of power. I guess it's loci of power within the ruling class. What forces does Trump represent? What forces does John Brennan represent? What forces does John Bolton represent? How are these things interacting with each other? What am I watching playing out on TV and in the newspapers every single day? An analysis of these things in their proper context is critical. And I feel that a lot of that segment of the left is unable to do that because of, I would argue, an addiction to opposing Democrats. And it's, in some sense, it's a good addiction, but it's one that I think blinds you to a lot of the other tasks that are before us in terms of organizing and in terms of strategy, because I don't believe it's hyperbole at all to say that what we're witnessing is the first stage of a very, very dangerous political movement that is evolving and developing in this country that I think a lot of people do not pay attention to and are not conscious of. And I think that's to our peril.
Right, right. And that, well, you know, the other thing is, the thing I found interesting about that article in particular was that you sort of blow up the whole issue with Trump and Russia in a way that will, I think, make everyone angry.
I probably. Tell me how you think that.
Well, I mean, you point out that, you know, Trump may speak like he's a dove when it comes to Russia, but his actions are very different from that.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And I just don't understand why that's difficult for people to understand. I still see people on the left saying that Trump, you know, Trump is bad and Trump is a racist and we don't like Trump, but he's avoiding World War III with Russia, and Hillary would have had a mushroom cloud over Moscow and a mushroom cloud over Washington literally before the inauguration. I mean, you know, that kind of hyperbole is sadly not even all that much of an exaggeration for some people within the kookier corners of the left. And my argument, as I think you're correct in saying, is that Trump is just a blabbermouth. Trump just shits out of his mouth all day long. He doesn't have any real thought behind anything he's saying. So he likes Putin as an individual. He'll flatter Putin and all the rest of that. At the same time, the policies do not demonstrate any kind of a detente. If anything, they demonstrate an escalation, and one that is quite dangerous, particularly given some of the other developments, both in terms of Eastern Europe and Europe broadly, but also just globally. I think it's quite dangerous, the attitude that not only Trump himself has towards all of these issues, but also the sort of hysteria that Trump has engendered within the anti-Trump elements of mainstream political society in the United States. So on the one hand, I see liberal hysteria over Russia. And on the other hand, I see this bizarre kind of denial of reality. And I just, it's difficult for me because I guess I end up fighting with everybody because I totally reject both of those positions. And I think that what we're actually talking about is a very complex and interrelated series of issues, some of which revolve around Trump and Russia, but more broadly revolve around geopolitical questions, strategic questions, economic issues, and political strategies, and I guess divergent political strategies. I know I'm sort of speaking in general terms, and if you want me to get more specific, I can. But the general argument that I'm making in that regard is simply this. Both camps are wrong. Terribly, terribly wrong. Trump is a warmonger of the worst kind. The difference is Trump is a fascist warmonger, not a corporate neoliberal imperialist warmonger. That's the difference. He's a different kind of warmonger. He's a different kind of brutal bastard than Obama or Hillary or any of, or Clinton or any of the others that came before them. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people are unwilling to accept that reality.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if you could, briefly get into some of the examples you bring up in the article about how Trump has actually escalated these conflicts geopolitically.
Well, sure. I mean, for one, well, I don't remember exactly which ones I named in the article there, but I could just kind of rattle off a couple of them. I think the obvious one is that Trump is has incredibly raised the specter of war with Iran. And I think it's incredibly dangerous. I obviously, it's not just John Bolton being in the position that he's in. It's also operators within the architecture of the imperial state. People in positions of power in the CIA and elsewhere who are executing this agenda. I'm thinking in particular of Mike D'Andrea. If people don't know who that is, Mike D'Andrea is the degenerate murderer who was responsible for the CIA drone program in Afghanistan for murdering, God knows, untold hundreds, maybe thousands of people, most of whom were innocent civilians. This is the person that Trump put in charge of psychological operations and subversion towards Iran. This is this is not some kind of, you know, conspiracy. I mean, this was in the New York Times and the Washington Post. This is the person who is involved in various subversion activities vis-a-vis Iran. That's incredibly dangerous. I mean, it's orders of magnitude more dangerous than anything Obama did with regard to Iran. Let's not forget that Obama, although the corporate neoliberal imperialist that he was, Obama did ultimately get an agreement, a treaty with Iran that actually was a step forward, although there were issues with that agreement. It was a step forward, and certainly a step forward for Iran towards re-entering the global economic market. And Trump has blown all that up. And that's very, very dangerous. Trump has inflamed tensions with Israel, or rather in the Middle East, by his recognition of the embassy in Jerusalem. This is an extremist position that is not supported by even some of the more rabid elements in the neocon establishment. I mean, you know, the far right certainly accepts it, but a lot of others don't. This is incredibly dangerous as well. We can point to a number of other examples, the death squad type tactics in Yemen and in Somalia and elsewhere. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, even in the Ukraine, I mean, he's still backing, he is still using the U.S. to back, Ukrainian ultra-nationalists. They're Nazis.
Yes, you know. Yes, absolutely. And not
and
only
that was happening under Obama, I believe, but it's continuing.
And actually, it's accelerated because Obama was very reticent to provide, you know, that quote unquote lethal weapons, right? The lethal, you know, lethal weaponry that would have significantly escalated that conflict at a very dangerous time. He was unwilling to do that, I think, because he understood. Well, I think he understood what the ramifications for him personally would be, because that's the kind of self-centered, egomaniac, narcissist that Obama is. That everything for him is in relation to himself and particularly his political legacy. So I think that that was his concern, probably more than, you know, human rights or, you know, the welfare and well-being of innocent people who are going to be murdered. But nevertheless, the policy was to provide some form of support in terms of funding and potentially also some kind of advisory, you know, individuals on the ground and so forth. But that was probably the extent of it to, you know, at least, you know, other than the tacit support. Trump, on the other hand, I think is escalating that. And I think that Trump has a very ignorant and one-dimensional view of all of these things. He thinks that he's going to, quote unquote, make a deal with Putin, right? He thinks that he's going to make a deal with Putin, you know, between Syria, Iran, and Ukraine. There's going to be some kind of horse trading that goes on where Trump can placate his neocon detractors by taking a hard line against Iran with the backing of Putin in exchange for the U.S. withdrawing from Syria, stopping its destabilization effort, and generally preventing it from getting more heavily involved in Ukraine. I think that that's probably the extent of Trump's understanding of these issues, and it's incredibly fucking dangerous what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, you know, this also gets into another interesting area, and you know, you've talked a bit about it with regards to Trumpism, but it's like this whole NATO thing. I mean, Trump may be critical of NATO, but what he wants out of NATO is the exact word you use is he wants a more robust, a more deadly, and a more provocative NATO. And it's interesting because you talk to these, when you hear these alt-right people, they play this game that they're really anti-war and isolationist. But the whole project of fascism demands expansion and dominance of other countries, you know, hostile takeovers. You know, it's like we're this talk is all a facade in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. It's as if they expect us to have forgotten that fascism inevitably leads to that kind of imperialist expansion. Certainly, I think you're at least tangentially alluding to like Lebensraum, you know, this sort of idea of living space for the German Reich, you know, that was like this foundational sort of core idea of Nazism. And certainly that's correct. I mean, there is that element. And of course, it's also dressed up in this sort of, very, very, destructive ethno supremacist and ethno nationalist kind of, mentality. And, that is precisely the kind of politics that Trump espouses. Now, whether Trump genuinely, you know, he's a true believer, or whether Trump is just exploiting sort of, you know, elements within U.S. society, or maybe it's a combination of the two, I don't know. And I don't really like the whole cottage industry of speculating on Trump's mental state, although, you know, other than just for humor purposes. But ultimately, I think that, yes, I think that Trump represents a very much an affinity towards, if not, reminiscence for, a kind of fascist expansionism in many ways. And, you know, this is, again, this kind of, I guess you could say, almost paradoxical sort of talking point, right? Where it's America first. We're focused on America. We're all about America. And at the same time, what is Trump actually doing around the world? I mean, this is the part that's the, I guess, the dimension of this story that those that I would say are in the pro-Trump left, or maybe I should say tacitly pro-Trump left, that they simply ignore the reality of what Trump is doing. And more importantly, I don't want to say more importantly, but equally importantly, the things that Trump wants to do, but for various reasons hasn't been able to do. Let's not forget, we're talking about all the things Trump is doing. Trump wanted to invade Venezuela. Trump wants to militarize Mexico, militarize the border with Mexico. He wants to expand U.S. funding for Plan Colombia. He wants to, I mean, he wants to put into overdrive all of the policies that during the Obama administration, us on the left, that we on the left were opposing. And I just, sometimes it's exasperating. Why is that so difficult for people to understand? Is it because they're hypnotized by Trump's words? I mean, if that's the case, that's really disheartening that people would be so focused on what Trump says and not at all focused on what Trump does. Now, I want to just say the most critical part of all of this for me is that I don't think ultimately that Trump is really the issue. To me, the issue is Trumpism.
You have an article about that as well. Let me pull it up. Trumpism, the real danger of Donald Trump, from August 2nd. So folks, read that one.
Yeah, and I don't mean to sound all, you know, apocalyptic and Armageddon, you know, doomsday-like, but the truth is that I think the real danger that we're facing is not a danger from Trump, and it's not even necessarily a danger from liberal Democrats and various other, you know, parts of the very much established political order. I think the real danger is a nascent fascist movement developing in this country that has been awakened by Trump, but that is not going to be dependent on Trump. In other words, Trump is for better or worse, he's a limited time only kind of political quantity, right? Whether that means that he's going to resign soon, or he's going to not run for a second term, or he loses in the election, or even he wins and he lasts for 8 total years. At some point in the not too distant future, Trump exits the political scene. But does that mean that the millions of people who are supporting him and supporting what I would call Trumpism, do they just disappear? Do they just go away? Do all of these structures that are being built, these affinity groups, these political sects, these organizations, do they just disband and disappear and go back into the woodwork like they never existed? I don't think so at all. I don't see any of the problems that engender that kind of radical far-right politics either going away or getting better anytime soon. I don't think the economic situation of working and poor white people is going to get better. It's certainly not going to get better for people of color and immigrants and others, but I don't think that situation is going to get better at all. So how much further does it go in the next 8 years or 10 years or 12 years or however long it is? In my opinion, what we're missing right now is a true believer, a leader, a real, honest-to-God, dyed-in-the-wool fascist leader does not exist yet. Trump is not that. Trump has some of those political affinities, but Trump is ultimately a malignant narcissist, as my friend Paul Street likes to say. He is, the worst kind of, you know, billionaire scumbag degenerate, but I would not call him a true believing fascist. I do think that that person exists, and I don't think that we've met him yet. And when we do meet him and his millions of followers who will be magnetized and will be attracted to that political pole, we're going to look back on this period and we're going to ask ourselves, geez, how did we not see that coming? How is it that nobody was talking about the fact that 65 million people in this country voted for Donald Trump? And many, 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 many millions of those people would stick with him to the very bitter end, and many more that don't stick with Trump but do stick with that politics. This is incredibly dangerous. I mean, we're now seeing, I just saw today, one of the most prominent groups within the militia movement, the Oath Keepers, are now saying that they're going to provide paramilitary-style training to their various followers and members in order to wage war against the left in the United States. I mean, this is 100% straight up fascist organizing. I mean, that's fascist organizing work. And now ask yourself this question. Who is it that is the biggest danger to Donald Trump right now? It's people with the name Cohen, Pecker. What's the CFO's name? Weisselman, Weisselberg, whatever it is. You see where I'm going with this. This is like straight out of the Nazi playbook, right? I can see all of these alt-right, Jews will not replace us, anti-Semitic, Rothschild run the world, Illuminati, whatever types who are going to look at what's happening to Trump and say, well, there you go. The Jews stabbed him in the back, or the commies, you know, those commies, they destroyed our guy. All he wanted to do was make America great again, and they wouldn't do it. They stabbed us in the back. Well, guess what? The stab in the back is exactly the phrase that the Nazis used in the early 1930s to describe
Night of the Long Knives.
Exactly. Thank you very much. So this is a historical parallel that I think we are foolish to ignore. And ultimately, all of the conditions that lead to the rise of fascism are in place in the United States. Well, maybe not all, but many of the conditions, preconditions for that kind of a movement are in place. And remember, when the quote-unquote establishment brings down Donald Trump, that feeling of betrayal will be a spark on the far right. And at this point in our history, the left is in no position to challenge that and to fight them in a real way in the streets. And that's my concern, and that's the danger, and that's why when I see lefties soft on Trump, it's very difficult for me to swallow.
Well, I don't know if you can go a little bit over, because there's some things I want to unpack with this, if you can.
Let's do it.
Well, the first thing is it's interesting, because I've actually heard people in this sort of like alt-right milieu even say that they don't consider Trump the end. He's a means to the end.
Yeah.
Which plays into exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and it's plain as day. I mean, even if you never heard one person from the alt-right say that, just look at the way that this is all developing. Look at the conditions that are aligning, the circumstances that are aligning to create that, and ask yourself this question. I mean, how many hardcore reactionary far-right elements can you think of in this country that are just waiting for an opportunity to have a national platform? I could think of a bunch, and I could think of a lot of different groups that would be very receptive to a lot of that kind of rhetoric, right? The rhetoric that your living standards have eroded because of immigrants, because of, free trade, whatever you want to say. There's 1,000 different things that you can kind of point to and, you know, with some justification. And at the end of the day, it is, as we've always seen historically, going to be those marginalized and oppressed groups that are typically going to be the target of that. And then also the sort of the other end of the spectrum, the historical enemy of the communist / Jew. And for fascists generally, communist and Jew are essentially synonymous with each other. And there are plenty of communists who are not Jews, but for Nazis and for fascists historically, communism is controlled by international Jewry, right? And so ultimately, a lot of these strands of fascist thought and fascist ideology, they're coming together in very, very dangerous ways. And look, let's take a look at somebody like Steve Bannon. Okay, Steve Bannon, right? Nobody cares about what role he had in the White House. What people need to understand about Bannon is that Bannon considers himself a theoretician. Bannon considers himself a thinker, a philosopher type, somebody who is essentially laying the groundwork for a movement. He is not the movement. He's not a leader of a movement. He's like an eminence grise, the gray eminence behind the scenes that kind of provides the ideological architecture for a far-right movement. And Bannon has been, somewhat successful. I think that some of his forays into electoral politics have failed, like Roy Moore and, a couple of the others that he endorsed. But broadly speaking, he's been very successful. He's welcomed with open arms by Le Pen and the National Front in France. He's welcomed with open arms by various fascist elements all over Europe. And ultimately, although he's not officially associated with them, he still has this very, very broad far-right platform with bright BART to be able to propagate a lot of these ideas. And this is one person. I'm talking about one guy. There's a bunch more that are right behind him. What do you think Stephen Miller is going to be 10 years from now? Stephen Miller, in my opinion, is probably one of the few people in the Trump administration that's most likely not going to go to prison for some kind of, clear crimes, right? So where does a person like Stephen Miller end up with in 10 years? Well, there's pretty good evidence to say that Stephen Miller actually was mentored by Richard Spencer, okay, because they were both at the same university in Duke, okay? So here's my question. Does Stephen Miller and Richard Spencer represent two slightly different but still parallel tracks within the far right? I would argue yes. And my fear is, what happens when those seemingly parallel tracks begin to converge? What happens when they see themselves in opposition to the entire body politic, both liberal and conservative? What happens when they meet up with these Oath Keepers and 3%ers and all of these other armed militia groups? I mean, I'm not trying to paint some kind of, dystopian future for us, but I do think that people are vastly underestimating the threat that we face in the next 20 years.
Yeah, and it gets at something when you talk about these parallel tracks, because, for my listeners that don't know, we mentioned the Night of the Long Knives, and that was the purge of elements of the Third Reich by Hitler, who were seen as too left-wing, quote-unquote left-wing. Yeah. And it gets into this issue of fascism is such a strange and horrendous beast, precisely because it is based around sort of mythology and a certain form of irrational romanticism. And for that reason, it's almost liquid in its in the way it operates, because the power of fascism is its ability to find ways to appeal to both the left and the right.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
I don't know if you can get into that. You did an interview with Alexander Reed Ross, the author of Against the Fascist Creep, which dealt with that a lot, but if you could cover it a little.
Sure. That interview is quite old now, but I've definitely recall some of the things we talked about, and generally speaking, I think that Alexander Reed Ross's thesis in the book is correct, namely that the kind of fascism that we're looking at is not one that's going to have an overnight takeover necessarily, but one that is essentially a creeping kind of fascism, wherein you have everything from entryists, that is, elements of a fascist movement that attempt to enter into non-fascist circles in order to either divide them or, more importantly, to win over some element within them. You have that kind of entryism going on. You also have a lot of the other conditions, including the mainstream of the Republican Party moving to the right, including the sort of rekindling of a lot of the fascist philosophers, whether Evola or Guénon, who are both, figures of adoration and respect for Bannon. Yeah, for Steve Bannon. Yeah.
Yeah, I've always found it funny that they like Guénon so much, and I'm not a fan of Guénon, but I always found it funny that they like him so much. He eventually, converted to Islam, but a lot of his online fanboys don't realize that.
Well, actually, I think I think you're right. I think some of them don't, but I think some of them do, and they like that aspect of it because it enables them to make inroads with what they see to be allies within the Muslim world, right? So that's why you see this bizarre, cheer section for somebody like Bashar al-Assad from the far right. It's not, it's not just a segment of the left anti-imperialist crowd that champions Assad. It's also, and probably even more prominently, the far right that does, including overt and open fascist groups that love Assad. I mean, you see some of these fascist groups when they're marching on the streets. I've seen video of some of them wearing Assad t-shirts, right? Because they see Assad as one of them. In other words, a white person fighting against a sort of barbarism, the creeping barbarism of the sort of Sunni takfiri or jihadi or whatever term people prefer to use, crowd, and that Assad is in many ways like Putin, kind of this heroic defender of Christendom, a heroic defender of Western civilization and all of these things. So there's sort of a loaded kind of political interpretation of a lot of these issues that are happening around the world from the far right. So yeah, I mean, in one sense, you know, the far right is deeply Islamophobic, but at the same time, the far right is also deeply anti-Semitic and yet loves Israel. So there is that sort of bizarre kind of seemingly paradoxical kind of politics there. And I think Israel is probably the perfect example where what they love about Israel is the fascism of it. They love the fascist elements that make the Israeli state, the apartheid and the white supremacy and sort of the ethno-separatism and all of these other things that ethno-nationalism, all of these elements that make this very, very despicable, almost pariah state that Israel has become, that makes that a symbol of adoration for the far right in this bizarre way. It's actually, I don't know, it's quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, and I mean, we also see it with the way the alt-right has been influenced by, for instance, the one I always bring up is Sorrell, who was sort of an anarcho-syndicalist at one point, but he becomes sort of the progenitor for fascist thought through his ideas about the working class and sort of this, he has this vitalistic, brutal view that they're the only ones that can overthrow the bourgeoisie, and he ends up becoming a main influence on Mussolini. You know, it's like fascism can absorb ideas from all different kinds of ideologies, and it's sort of, you know, can become a net to try to bring people who you wouldn't think would turn that way into that sort of line of thought, that fascist way of thinking.
Absolutely. And I think you're 100% right. And I would, the only thing I would add to that is that it appeals to the left and to the right for, in many ways, the same reason, or I should say, it appeals to the left and to the left and to the right, not for the same reasons, but in the same way. And what I mean by that is fascism, unlike, say, communism, or unlike really any other ideology, fascism is a universal antidote. It is the fix. It is the cure-all. It is the panacea for social problems, right? There's no communist and Marxist literature anywhere that describes socialism and communism in those terms. It has some utopian ideas. It has a vision of a unknown, you know, or a very distant future in which you have a full communist kind of society. But communism and socialism and Marxism generally understand the sort of transitional phases and the contradictions and all of these different elements that make the complex sort of society that we live in. Fascism papers over all of that. What fascism does is it purports to have the answer. It purports to have the cure, the magic pill that will restore greatness, whether it is restoration of the greatness of Germany that was needlessly and villainously stabbed in the back by the Social Democrats and the Jews and the Versailles Treaty. And if only we could just right that wrong, we could make Germany great again. Well, I use that phrase for an obvious reason, because there is that clear and unmistakable element within Trumpism. Make America great again. It's not an actual strategy of anything. It is an abstraction. It is a cure for the abstract ills. And one thing that I would just point out, and I'm not going to take credit for it myself. This actually comes from a professor at Yale, Jason Stanley, who has a forthcoming book called How Fascism Works. And he has a very interesting take that I think is worth consideration, namely that the base for Trump they're not concerned about all of the obvious forms of corruption that Trump represents. Corruption of, you know, campaign finance laws, or corruption of, you know, God knows, anything really, right? They're not concerned about that, because in their mind, that's not real corruption. Corruption is not corruption of the law. Corruption is corruption of the spirit. Corruption of tradition, corruption of traditional structures, corruption of the family, corruption of religion, corruption of traditional society. This is the corruption that they're concerned with. And for them, there's no amount of political and financial corruption that Trump could be involved in that would ever shake them from the fact that Trump represents an attempt to recapture the purity of what America was, that which made America great initially. And, you know, I'm not trying to turn this interview into a you know, plug for all of my articles, but I did write a piece in December of 2016. This was just a couple of weeks after Trump was elected. And I would urge people to Google the article. It was, I don't want to, you know, speak out of school here, but I think it was the first article written on the subject, and the title was Donald Trump and the Triumph of White Identity Politics. And that was in December of 2016. It appeared in the print issue of Counterpunch, and it's also now online. And in that article, I talk about a lot of these issues that Trump represented the very first time in modern politics where white people and whiteness represented what's called entitativity. In other words, a feeling of shared belonging to a collective whole, right? In other words, historically, there is no such thing as white America, right? There's the Catholic in New York City. There's the Methodist in the Midwest. There's the Baptist in the South, or, you know, whatever, right? But there was no white people. There was no white America, not in a real way. And
I think mythology. It's right. A mythology. That's what MAGA is. It's a myth.
Yes, right, exactly. And within that myth is the embedded sort of understanding that white people in America represent a cohesive unit, a cohesive whole, and that those white people are under attack. And you see the parallel to that today in the news, with Trump making these absolutely idiotic statements about white farmers in South Africa, right? Once again, those who own 85% of the land and who control the vast majority of the wealth and who have historically oppressed the vast majority of the population, they are now victims. You see how quickly the fascist mindset is able to turn the oppressor into the oppressed, and then to weaponize that understanding. That's part of what makes fascism so dangerous, but also so appealing to a lot of people.
Well, it's, yeah, and they take ideas and they twist them. Like for instance, yeah. A person like Steve Bannon will talk about his hatred for Wall Street because he worked at one point for Goldman Sachs and things like that. But it's not from this left wing or Marxist position, where it's a systemic analysis. It's a systemic problem. You know, the far right, they look at it and they say, well, it's the Jews.
Yep.
You know, they boil these things down and come to these horrific, you know, wrong-headed conclusions. They don't look at it systemically. It's almost like it always becomes a conspiracy theory for them.
Well, and I think that's an appropriate term, because I think the world of the conspiracy theory overlaps quite significantly with these fascist politics that I've been talking about. Now, I just want to add this quick little caveat. I'm not suggesting that everyone associated with conspiracism and conspiracy thinking and 9/11 truth and all of these other things, that every one of them is a fascist. I'm not suggesting that. What I am saying, though, is that ultimately that worldview is rooted in a fascist politics. It's part of the reason why the Nazis were so keen to kind of harp on the Rothschild, the banking families, the secret cabal of Jews, right? To use that as, in many ways, the archetype of everything evil, everything corrupting, all of the corrupting influences, the corruption of Christianity, the corruption of the economy, the corruption of the political process, all of these things were to be sort of cast as you know, corruption by the Jew, right? The Jew, again, being sort of this archetype. And there's a reason why fascists since 1945 have had to kind of couch a lot of those ideas, a lot of those fascist ideas in these various conspiracy realms and saying things like, well, I'm not a fascist. I'm just, I'm concerned about finance, global finance and its influence and all of these other things. But the reality is that there's a direct line from the conspiracy world of today going back to the Nazis in the 1930s and from there going back even further to the secret police under the Tsar in the Russian Empire, which, for instance, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion comes out of that period in the late 19th century in Tsarist Russia, where the pogrom was in many ways kind of the ultimate expression of sort of a proto-fascist kind of worldview, wherein the problems of a particular municipality or the problems of a particular village or whatever could be picked on the usurer, the Jew, the accountant, the merchant, the shyster, all of these other things. Well, all of these archetypes, all of these sort of ideas that are deeply embedded in this body of thought, they're all now having a semi renaissance under Trump and in this period with the alt-right and all of these other things. And that's why, to me, the danger is not so much the organizations themselves, although they are very dangerous, particularly those militia groups and others. But the danger to me is the ideas and the way in which the ideas are being propagated and passed down and the way in which they're going to be sort of used to buttress an increasingly paranoid and increasingly fascist and increasingly violent worldview. And I really hope that people are taking that threat seriously.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We'll start wrapping up in a second here, but I do want to touch upon this real quick. You mentioned that conspiracy theory. There's people that believe in conspiracy theories that aren't necessarily right wing, and I always think about Professor Peter Dale Scott, who was the person who helped popularize the term deep state. The difference with Peter Dale Scott and an Alex Jones character is Peter Dale Scott was just saying that there's these, systemic forces at work. He wasn't saying that there's like this broad overarching conspiracy of Jews or the Illuminati or any of that. People like him and Alfred McCoy, they would say, well, conspiracies happen, but it's not this, it's not a grand narrative type thing.
Right. Absolutely. And I think more to the point, and just to illustrate, the point that you're making, look, I will always point to a number of examples that I think illustrate it. Those are just conspiracy theories. Well, we have to be able to separate conspiracy theories that are not backed by evidence and conspiracies that are, because those conspiracies are very common. They happen every single day. And in fact, capitalism does not exist without various and overlapping and interlocking conspiracies. And a perfect example of that, which came to light a few years ago, was the LIBOR scandal. I mean, if people remember, the LIBOR scandal had to do with this bank exchange rate that was fixed in London, where you had a very small group of very influential bankers who would meet regularly and would essentially conspire to fix the rates that would be most beneficial to them. Rather than allowing that rate to, say, be dictated by market forces or whatever, they would conspire with each other to fix that rate. Well, that's a conspiracy. And in fact, that's a conspiracy of very wealthy and very powerful people that had a global impact. It had an impact on global financial markets. It had an impact on everything from, interest rates to a whole bunch of other things. So, that's a very real conspiracy and one that has very tangible consequences and one that is not only proven and understood, but now kind of a historical footnote. And you could compare a conspiracy like that, or a conspiracy like the CIA overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, or the assassination of Lumumba in the Congo, or 100 other examples that I could point to. Those are real, proven, true conspiracies. But as you mentioned, the grand narrative, the grand conspiracy, this is something that is actually quite different. It is not an attempt to explain a specific or concrete historical episode. Rather, it is an attempt to explain all historical episodes, all of history, all of the forces that are at work, you know, in our society, and to sort of, you know, to give the believer sort of the key, right? The, what was that in Beetlejuice, right? The skeleton key, the key that opens all the doors. That's what Alex Jones offers, right? For the low, low 995 or whatever the hell he charges, right? He gives you this magic key to open all of the hidden doors to the hidden and esoteric knowledge that is being, you know, concealed from us by the globalists and the New World Order and all of this. Well, in fact, that is right out of the fascist playbook. That's exactly what fascists do. They want to give you the magic key, the cure-all, the pill, that if you just take it, this will cure all of our problems. And oh, by the way, that pill means organizing in the streets, beating people up, oppressing people, sending them to camps, murdering them, and waging war.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's even with when I look at that term deep state, like I don't have much of a problem with the idea that we have an entrenched bureaucracy, but I don't think that's what people who support Trump often mean when they say the deep state. They're obviously pointing towards something much bigger, this sort of fantasy of, you know, the guys in the dark rooms smoking cigarettes and watching the Kennedy assassination. You know, we have to be able to parse those things out.
Absolutely, and I think you're right in the sense that the Trumpists who talk about the deep state, they're not talking about the sort of embedded, you know, network that is constantly regenerating itself within the various institutions that make up the empire, right? Be they the military industrial sector, the intelligence and surveillance sector, the mercenary contractors, and all of the rest of them, the politicians and the financiers behind the politicians and all of that, you know. If you wanted to do a kind of systemic analysis of all of these things, or even, dare I say, a structural analysis of all of these things, well, that's kind of getting into the Peter Dale Scott versus Noam Chomsky debate territory, where, you know, they're both, I think, right, and they're both kind of wrong in various ways, but both are genuinely trying to come to some kind of an understanding about the forces at work and what makes up what you know, the term that Marxists use, the ruling class, right? So those are, I think, you know, genuine attempts at understanding that. But you're right, the Trumpists see the deep state not as, you know, this sort of embedded interlocking network, but rather a kind of cabal that is conspiring against Trump. And that cabal could includes everybody from, you know, Hillary Clinton and Democrats to John Brennan and former intelligence officials to Anderson Cooper and, you know, CNN and MSNBC and, you know, the Jews and the Southern Poverty Law Center and God knows what else they would throw in as tools of the deep state. Oh, by the way, I'm a tool of the deep state, in case you didn't know. I'm a tool of the deep state for daring to bring up all the issues that we've been talking about in this interview. I think that the phenomenon of QAnon, I think, is a perfect example of how easy it is to kind of hoodwink people who are willing, who are sort of conditioned themselves to believe almost anything vis-a-vis conspiring against Trump, to the point where they're willing to listen to people like, you know, Robert David Steele and the sex colonies on Mars, to the pedophile sex rings and the dungeons under pizza parlors and all of the rest of this complete horseshit. They're willing to accept all of that because they've already sort of have this sort of prima facie understanding that the deep state exists, it conspires against Trump, and only the people who support Trump can be seen as, you know, not part of it.
And what's really scary about it now is they've pretty successfully made this stuff mainstream. You know, Sean Hannity, yep, drops references to QAnon. I mean, Tucker Carlson, you know, this monster on Fox News, he is pushing these alt-right, far-right lines now out in the open. You know, so it's all coming together now.
Well, and that's and you're right. And that's exactly what I'm talking about and why I think it is dangerous. And I actually think the danger is increasing because the more on the ropes Trump becomes and the more rocky things get for him, the more those people are going to ratchet up the rhetoric, the more extreme their politics become, and the more willing they're going to be to embrace those voices that would otherwise be sort of shunned as socially unacceptable, right? That's why you had that's why you have Trump saying, well, there's good people on both sides in Charlottesville. He's not suggesting that he's even-handed. What he's saying is that the fascists are okay in my book. In other words, they need to be accepted as part of society. In other words, they are part of us. They are part of our world, our society, and we should respect them. That's what this whole free speech canard is about. It's not about free speech. It's about protecting fascist speech. It's about making sure that a space exists where fascists can propagate their politics and their worldview. It's about preventing the left and progressives and well-meaning people from stamping out this sort of nascent fascist movement. And frankly, that is one of our historical tasks. And I mentioned it already, but, you know, I mentioned this in the beginning of our conversation, but for me in 2016, it wasn't just the election of Trump. It was also that I became a father. And I started to think about things in a different way. And I started to become very practical in my thinking about 30 years in the future and 20 years in the future. And what are things going to look like when my boy is ready to go to college? What is this society going to look like? Those are questions that, to be honest with you, I didn't always think about in the time before that. And I began to think about them. And the more I thought about them and the more that I saw the conditions on the ground in this country, particularly in the last 18 months, the more worried I've become that the trajectory we're on is an incredibly dangerous one that leads deep into the abyss.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, you even have these mainstream voices like, Lou Dobbs recently said of the Unite the Right 2 rally, he referred to the protesters as so-called white supremacists. And then
right.
you have Richard Spencer has even admitted to what you're saying. Richard Spencer was asked a while back about if the alt-right really believes in free speech. And he said, of course not. That's just rhetoric.
Yeah. Exactly. In that regard, I love Richard Spencer because he is one of the few that is willing to, for the most part, be relatively honest about what it is that they're after. I mean, I say I love Richard Spencer. Somebody's going to take that fucking excerpt and really hammer me with it. But
he may be honest to some extent, but I still feel like he's lying when he says peaceful ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, yes. I'm of course kidding in a sense. I'm not. I don't genuinely think he's anything but pond scum that needs to get punched in the face repeatedly. But the point is, I think that Richard Spencer, to a large extent, represents sort of the for lack of a better word, the authentic voice of fascists in America, one that is unabashed in some senses. Although you're right, I think he still hides behind a lot of rhetoric and a lot of this very annoying sort of quasi irony that's not really ironic, but they pretend it's irony in order to kind of deflect the fact that they're fascists. He represents a lot of those tendencies, but he's right in a sense that he does represent sort of the authentic fascist versus what he considers to be sort of the soft, the alt-light, as it were, the Mike Chernovich, Cassandra Fairbanks sort of world of these, worshippers of the Proud Boys and all of these other types who are not necessarily overtly fascist, but who are essentially fascist. I think that what we're witnessing now is for lack of a better word, the birth pains of a fascist movement, one that doesn't exist yet, but one that will very soon, I think, exist in a more cohesive way. And what it's going to take, as I mentioned earlier, it's going to take a leader. which they don't have yet, but they will. They'll find one. He may be in some state legislature in Michigan or in Alabama or whatever, or he may be, you know, just graduating from college now or wherever he may be. And I say he because, well, for obvious reasons, you know, wherever he may be right now, he is coming to the scene and he'll be here sooner rather than later. And I think we should really try to play out in our minds how this is going to go. And when we do that, I think we begin to see the tasks before us as all the more imperative and all the more immediate. And that kind of brings me back to this whole question of pro-Trump lefties, where they may not be openly in favor of Trump, but they essentially run interference for Trump. I can't think of something more unproductive given the crisis we're facing today. And that's why, you know, I'll take all the smears, I'll take all the attacks, I'll take all the anger from people when they read those pieces, because that's okay with me. I'm willing to accept it as long as people are willing to think about what it is I wrote.
And, you know, I always tell people that I like to wrap up these conversations on a positive note. So is there anything you think we can do, or any directions that are you know, good that we're going in?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so much good that's happening right now. I mean, there are social movements that are taking root. I think that there are a number of people who I would consider friends of mine who are doing some really exciting work. I think that, you know, for instance, I don't know if I should be name dropping or not, but you know, whatever. Cooperation Jackson, Kali Akuno and the Cooperation Jackson crew down in Mississippi are doing some amazing work on building a resilient community, one that is independent, truly independent in an economic and in a sort of semi-political way as well. I think that there are other examples, other forays, the Fearless Cities movement and these other things that are happening. Obviously, the Black Lives Matter and these other elements as well. And I think that ultimately one thing that the left is in some sense is not paying attention to enough, but it needs to, is the rapid development of technology. Technologies that are going to allow us to do things and to organize in new ways that we desperately need, because right now we are disorganized, we are scattered, we are weak, and we're not prepared to take on the challenge of fighting against fascism. And so, you know, whether it's developments in 3D printing, whether it's developments in new technologies regarding medical care and treatments and gene therapy and all of these things that are becoming DIY and open source, the open source movement, I think, is very powerful and has tremendous impact for the left and for progressives and socialists and anarchists and commies and all of us. I think that there are many other examples of movements and ideas and organizations that are really doing a lot. We started this conversation talking about Barrett Brown. I think his Pursuance Project is really exciting, a great way to develop more information and develop networks that are not dependent upon social media for information. I mean, you know, and again, I think that increasingly, you know, as we've seen in confrontations against the far right now, we're seeing people coming together, not necessarily over entirely shared politics, but over shared antipathy towards fascism. And that needs to be nurtured and that needs to be fostered. Now, obviously, there's problems with that, too. We can't simply say that every liberal is an ally, because they're not. A lot of liberals aren't our allies. A lot of liberals are today on the freaking news championing Jeff Sessions, for Christ's sake, a neo-Confederate fascist attorney general. They're championing. Why? Because he's having a little tiff with Trump. This is, of course, the unproductive side of what happens in the, you know, the media world. But there's a lot of really exciting developments, including all the things I mentioned, urban agriculture, many, many other things that are happening. A lot of my friends are involved in many different projects, and I would urge people to you know, go to Counterpunch and other to your podcast, to other sources of information that are not only highlighting the problems and the conflicts, but that are also giving attention to a lot of the solutions that are being developed right now around the world, because it's a very, very exciting time and we have a very real responsibility given everything we've talked about. And then I'll just drop one last phrase to make people depressed, climate change. Climate change is a very serious issue that we should be thinking about, not simply in terms of environmentalism, but in terms of human suffering. What's going to happen when millions of human beings have to flee their homes? What kind of global turmoil is that going to create? And what kind of a politics is that going to engender? I sure hope people on the left are thinking about those type of things for the next 10, 20 years and developing strategies for addressing them. That's kind of where my head is at. That's what I like to focus on, in addition to all the politics. And hopefully that's what some of your listeners are thinking about too.
Definitely. And, you know, the last thing, in regards to all this positive stuff, I think a lot of good has been done with the protests of ICE.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. Perfect example. I think that they have really centered, you know, this sort of Gestapo that exists in the United States now, these damn near, military style, force that exists in this country. The fact that abolish ICE has been a trending hashtag on Twitter and that it's now a question on the lips of mainstream politicians that are being asked in open forums and on television about that, I think that's a tremendously positive development. And I think that it really needs to be capitalized on and it needs to be pushed forward even further. But And I'll just say this, and I mentioned this at the beginning of our conversation when I was involved in Occupy. One of the things that really hurt Occupy and ultimately I think led to its demise was a very, I think, incorrect affinity for and attachment to leaderlessness. And I think that we would be fools to think that we're going to take on the imperial state and the various institutions and arms that it operates without leadership, without organization, without discipline, and without strategy. Those are the things that we're desperately going to need if we're going to organize a true resistance and not just some liberal democratic hashtag. We need to be thinking about these questions and we need to be organizing ourselves, and we can't be doing it solely on Facebook. We have to be doing it in the real world, because it's in the real world where real people live and real politics plays out.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Everyone, check out Eric's work at Counterpunch and Counterpunch Radio, and also check out Eric's Patreon page.
Yeah, thank you so much for plugging that. Listeners, if you want to hear more of my work, obviously, you can Counterpunch Radio and also patreon.com/Eric Draitser, ericdraitser. More podcasts and interviews, articles, essays, photography. There's a whole bunch more stuff up there, so do check that out. And thanks so much for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Eric Draitser. And consider checking out his work at Counterpunch Radio. You can also read his articles over at Counterpunch as well. And I would highly recommend donating to his Patreon page, which, as I said in the intro, you can find in the episode description. And to close out this edition of Parallax Views, I have a musical number in tribute and honor of the recently passed away Senator John McCain, a man who never met a war he didn't like. The track is War Pimp Renaissance by Lard. Here's to you, John. Here's to you. Yeah.